Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin by following up on yesterday's conversation with Simon Johnson, the former chief economist at the IMF, who called the jobs bill now before the Senate a colossal mistake of historic proportions. The former chief prosecutor of the savings and loan banksters, William K. Black, joins us to detail the disastrous deregulation in this bipartisan bill. He has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Jobs Act is so criminogenic that it guarantees full-time jobs for criminologists." Then we'll look into the apparent murder of a 17-year-old boy by a wannabe cop who was sanctioned by Florida law to carry a concealed weapon with which he killed the unarmed victim. But because of another Florida law, the Stand Your Ground law, the perpetrator is able to blame the victim and has so far not been charged with a crime. Ken Adams, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, which is nearby to the scene of the crime, will explain how imagining that a crime is taking place can justify homicide. Then finally, Nancy Cohen joins us in the studio. She is the author of Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. We will discuss her groundbreaking investigation into the shadow movement that fuels our political wars and the current war on women that Republican presidential candidates, Republican state legislatures, and the Republican House are waging. I'm now joined by William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loans disasters of the 1980s. Currently is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Jobs Act is so criminogenic that it guarantees full-time employment for criminologists." Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And yesterday I spoke with the former chief economist for the IMF, Simon Johnson, who calls the jobs bill a colossal mistake of historic proportions. You have, since you have a background in prosecuting bank fraud, you're warning in your article in the Huffington Post that this is, well, you're basically saying you've never seen anything like this. This is open season. This bill's an atrocity.
Yes, they call it an atrocity, and it's not just me. We have on it Gil Geis, who is the greatest living white-collar criminologist in America. Henry Pontel, his colleague at UC Irvine, who is certainly one of the top five criminologists in America. Lynn Stout, a fabulous professor, and experts in the field of finance, Barry Ritholtz and Ms. Tavolacki. So a whole group of folks realize that this is the wish list of all of the frauds brought forward. This thing was a feeding frenzy once it got to Congress of lobbyists trying to add just horrific provision after horrific provision, all with the cynicism of calling this a jobs bill. This bill will destroy millions of jobs. It will not create any jobs.
And of course, JOBS is an acronym for Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. And its proponents are largely the stock exchange, venture capital groups, biotech startups, investment banks, and the same bottom feeders that encouraged the payday loans. Against it, though, are the current and former chairman of the Security, along with yourself, Bill Black, and the others that you mentioned, the current and former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Association of State Security Regulators, AARP, the Consumer Federation of America, the AFL-CIO, and other unions and several big pension funds and many prominent security experts. However, it passed the House with only 25 Democrat votes against it, with the help of the White House, I might add. And now they're trying to fast-track it through the Senate, all in the name of bipartisanship. And it won't be long before the president will have a photo opportunity hailing bipartisanship in creating jobs.
Yes, and it's a grand kumbaya moment, and they're all very proud of themselves, and they all know that it is a complete lie, but it's a political season. and they all stand to benefit from it personally. So back up a step. Everybody that has any expertise in dealing with fraud opposes this bill and opposes it in the strongest possible terms. Everybody that represents consumer and investor interests opposes this bill. This bill is supposedly for investors, right? And for consumers and getting jobs. All the people that represent the workers oppose this bill. What you're seeing is how dominant finance has been made by the Citizens United decision. That one industry can now, after a track record of complete disaster through fraud, fraud after fraud after fraud in many different contexts, in the origination of the mortgages, in the sale of the mortgages, in the sale of the derivative toxic waste, and then in the foreclosure process. And case after case and investigation after investigation has documented the pervasive fraud by the elite investment bankers. And what is their answer to the problem of fraud? More fraud.
Well, but the MO is the same as the MO that led up to the savings and loan crash, and that is the deregulation of the Glass-Steagall protections that were in there since the 1930s. These protections that they're stripping out in the name of jobs and freeing, unshackling the entrepreneurs we're going to go back to the 1920s, right?
Yes, and people need to know that the golden era for the United States was under effective securities regulation. Securities regulation began just over 100 years ago in Kansas with the Blue Sky Laws. And when the first state entities to deal with securities fraud were created and they reviewed securities filings, they found every single one of them was fraudulent. Go forward in time. The United States adopts an effective Securities and Exchange Commission, and it becomes, in many ways, the most effective federal regulatory body for many years. What did we learn as economists? We learned that U.S. equities, in other words, stocks, traded at a substantial premium over the stocks of any other country. Why? Because people trusted the United States stocks far more because we had effective regulation. That was good for honest companies. That was good for investors. That was good for our economy. And then a bunch of theoclassical economists who literally, I'm going to quote them, a rule against fraud is not essential or even particularly important in securities. That was the insanity that they believed, which is contrary to all human experience.
Well,
they destroyed regulation, and they produced not just one crisis, the savings and loan crisis, but then the Enron-era crisis, and then this crisis that have cost the household sector over $11 trillion, has cost Americans at least 8 million jobs of ones lost and not created, and in Europe and elsewhere in the world, another 12 to 20 million jobs. So fraud is the great engine of mass destruction of wealth, of economy, of communities, and of jobs, and that's what these people have brought. And it is disgusting. They should be ashamed. They should be driven from office with this kumbaya stuff as they celebrate turning America over to the thieves.
Again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, as a former litigation director of the Federal Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. And he was the director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. And Harry Reid is pushing this, the Senate Majority Leader, as is Senator Chuck Schumer, so is the President. Part of the bill, of course, this so-called Jobs Act is going to strip out and undo the safeguards that were put in the Sarbanes-Oxley law that was a response to the Enron and the WorldCom disasters. So this is the triumph for the banking lobby. They undid Glass-Steagall, and we got the savings and loan disaster, but they've all been made whole thanks to the taxpayer. And now there's this little impediment that came out because of Enron and these other frauds like WorldCom, and now they're getting rid of that. And and all of our top politicians are celebrating. And what's particularly cynical about this is Harry Reid is fast-tracking this bill, and he has he's going to allow the Democrats who oppose it to have a vote. But that vote will have to be go to the 60 votes filibuster level. So that way they know it won't pass, but they get political cover.
Yeah, it is shameful what is being done, and it's being done by both parties. And there, you know, there isn't really even an articulated cause on the other side. Here is their explanation for why we need to do this. There is a regulatory race to the bottom. If we don't do this, then the City of London will do it. And then the fraudulent investor groups, you know, trying to defraud people, will move to the City of London. Now, A, that would be a great thing for America if it happened. But B, it's not going to happen because of our capital markets are so much broader than in the City of London. C, remember, these are the same folks pushing this, the Chamber of Commerce, who, what is their reaction every single time when a manufacturing plant closes in America and reopens in China? They say, that's fine, that's how the world is supposed to work. As soon as it's a finance firm that might move, no, the heavens will fall if that will happen. Think of this. The name is regulatory race to the bottom. If you engage in the race, by definition, you lose. So the only possible answer is not to engage in the race to the bottom, to fight for honesty.
Well, it sounds, though, like this bill is going to open up a whole new avenue to stock offerings. They're going to happen over the internet. And
yes,
and I get the feeling that we're going to end up with, you know, you see all those ads on the internet, and Rush Limbaugh used to have them on, what's his name? Glenn Beck used to have them on his TV show all the time, of these shysters selling gold coins and other ridiculous, rip-offs. Aren't they going to be selling stocks and offering up IPOs online now?
That is their goal. The proponents of the bill want to take something that we know is a leading tactic of pump and dump frauds, where you, as you say, on the web, pump it up with all this phony publicity that's easy to generate because of the way emails work in the modern era. You bring in the victims that boost the shares, and then the people running the fraud sell, and the victims are left with disastrous losses. That is a pure fraud mechanism. They call it cloud fundraising. And it will be a disaster. Everybody knows it will be a disaster. I don't think well of Congress, and I don't think particularly well of the Obama administration in the financial sphere. But I could not believe when I read these provisions that they had become this bad and that virtually no one in Congress would fight it.
Well, yeah, Carl Levin's, I think, fought it in the Senate. But as I mentioned, only 25 Democrats voted against it in the House bill. And it looks like, because of the procedural games that Harry Reid's are playing, that they will eventually vote on the House bill, but they'll give the dissenters in the Senate cover by voting amendments that won't pass because of the 60-vote threshold.
That's correct. And unless we hold those people accountable for that cynicism, and the administration, which is organizing this with Senator Reid, there is going to be every incentive for them to continue to do it. The disaster will come later. It'll come, you know, later in Obama's next term if he's reelected. But he doesn't care. He'll be reelected. That's his concern now, entirely, reelection.
And this is all to do with the blackmail that the banking lobby have, that, you know, if, unless you give us everything we want, we won't give you any money. And we're already giving most of our money to Romney at any rate. What's the chances of Obama getting any payback from, I mean?
No, this is a stupid deal from his standpoint as well. But it's a measure of the fact that politics and the search for financing trumps everything. There are no principles left, because this one is so far beyond the pale. He could not have had an honest briefing, although people need to demand that. Who in the administration recommended this bill? Who was involved in the drafting of the administration? Who signed off on these pump-and-dump schemes, these obvious fraud mechanisms? You know, if we can't hold the, you know, everyone accountable, let's start holding the people accountable who at least were used as the tools, and then hold the more powerful folks, accountable when we can in elections.
Is this Cass Sunstein's work? Who do you know who's doing this, or would it be you'd have to?
This is the. This actually is bipartisan in the sense of they simply opened it up to the lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Chamber of Commerce, is what you're seeing. Their wish list, ever since passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, has been to gut Sarbanes-Oxley. Their other announced priority, by the way, is to gut the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, so we can go back to bribing foreign heads of state with impunity.
On the basis that the other countries have the advantage of being able to bribe the Saudis and sell their weapons ahead of us, you know.
That's right. So it's, again, the competition and laxity, mm-hmm. the race to the bottom, and, you know, everybody loses under this dynamic. Regulation is destroyed, integrity is destroyed, fraud rises, unemployment surges. This is a massive, this is the largest threat to jobs in America. And they are calling it a jobs bill. That is how disgustingly hypocritical they are.
Well, look what's happening with how the American consumer is being ripped off at the gas pump, and everything in the media are these fairy tales that they tell about all kinds of reasons why it has nothing to do with speculation on Wall Street, when it has everything to do with speculation on Wall Street. I've spoken to Michael Greenberger, formerly with the Commodity Future Trading Commission, Fidel Geit, considered the leading expert on oil and gas markets. He says a third of the price is due to speculation.
Here's the proof is the pudding. And what did the House of Representatives insist on doing under the Republicans as a top priority? And that was cutting back on the Commodities Future Trading Commission budget, because the CFTC announced that it was going to crack down on precisely this kind of speculative and money rigging, you know, market rigging.
Right. They were going to bring in position limits, and then the big banks like Goldman Sachs had now tied them up in lawsuits.
And what was the last time that this industry got together to crush the Commodities Future Trading Commission? Well, Michael, who you spoke to and who is superb, could tell you about it firsthand. And you can, of course, anyone of your listeners can see online for free the warning. The last time was the passage of the Commodities Future Modernization Act, which immunized, under the same race to the bottom logic, that we had to out-compete the City of London for weakness. It immunized from all regulation credit default swaps.
Right, and that was when they fired Brooksley Bourne, because she was the head of the CTFC who was warning against and trying to fight and stop it, right?
Yeah, they didn't fire her.
No, they didn't fire her.
When they passed a statute that said, not only can you not pass a particular regulation that you're considering that would regulate credit default swaps, we now withdraw all statutory authority to regulate them. And that law is a eerily foreshadows the current act, the Jobs Act, because that law, the Commodities Future Modernization Act of 2000, explicitly exempts credit default swaps from the operation of state bucket shop laws. Bucket shops are fraudulent securities sales. Can you imagine passing a law at the federal level immunizing fraud? That's what we've come to in America.
Well, William K. Black, I thank you very much for joining us here and filling us in on what's in this bill that's before the Senate. And I guess people should be calling the White House and demanding that they do what you suggested.
And every member of the congressional delegation.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Jobs Act is so criminogenic that it guarantees full-time employment for criminologists. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about how it was that a wannabe cop could imagine somebody was about to commit a crime, kill them in cold blood, and get away with murder. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ken Adams, who's a professor of criminal justice in the College of Health and Public Affairs at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Adams.
Well, thank you.
And as you, I'm sure, are aware, Ken, the entire focus of the nation appears to be zeroing in on Orlando, or at least the city slightly to the north. Is that right, Sanford?
Yes, Sanford's a bit to the north, and we're getting a lot of attention, perhaps attention people don't want, I guess, it's not enjoyable, but the number of stories on Google have been increasing astronomically.
And at this point, in terms of investigations, the Florida State stepped in some time ago, and now the Justice Department stepped in today. Can you walk us through the jurisdictions and who's in charge?
Sure. The incident took place in Sanford, which is an incorporated municipality north of Orlando. So the Sanford Police Department handled the initial investigation. At that time, they decided there was no evidence that a crime was committed, because the Mr. Zimmerman, who's the person who shot the gun, was claiming self-defense. Then there was a lot of consternation. Sanford has a long history of racial tension. And so the person doing the shooting, Mr. Zimmerman, has been described as white and alternatively as Hispanic. And the victim in this case is Trayvon is African American. And so the African American community, which is reasonably well organized in Sanford, took objection to the fact that the police seemed to not do anything. The p- police claimed there was nothing they could do because there was a lack of evidence. Subsequently, as this evolved, the police made available bits and pieces of information, transcripts of the 911 calls, and then the actual recording of the recording of the call itself. At some point, then the police chief said, "We're open to have anyone come in," and at that point, the Florida State Police said that they would assist in the investigation, so they will come down.
Well, of course, in retrospect, it's hard to imagine how a young, 16 or 17-year-old
17, yeah.
Yeah, boy on his way to the corner store, I think he's actually coming back armed with a packet of Skittles and an iced tea, could be shot down by somebody I guess it's a function of today's wired society that there is all this evidence now, not just Zimmerman on the 911 call, but Trayvon Martin himself was on the cell phone talking with his 16-year-old friend in Miami. And then there's all the extemporaneous 911 calls when the shooting erupted. And what is particularly hard to understand is why from the get-go, the police, some witnesses say the police actually coached Zimmerman into saying self-defense, self-defense. Is this a function of the Florida law that I believe that was passed in 2005 that allows this, I don't know what to call it, ambiguity, this legal protection to Mr. Zimmerman?
Well, yes. In 2005, Florida passed what they call the Stand Your Ground law. And the short of it is that we've always, the legal system has always used the concept of self-defense. That's even built into that term. There's this notion that it's a defense. By that, it's not only defending yourself, it also means that it's your legal defense if charged. And then within that context, there's something called the Castle Doctrine, which essentially says that a man's home is his castle and that if someone comes in, you can use force. The reason the Castle Doctrine evolved was that there was a doctrine that simultaneously existed that was called the duty to retreat, so that if one is threatened or attacked, one has the duty to retreat and fall back as much as possible, if possible. Okay, and so in other words, to essentially escape or avoid the confrontation. And this evolved because the notion at the time was that the king's army and the king's men were in charge of keeping order and that they would handle it. And so that same kinds of concepts have transferred over to us in terms of the police. The Stand Your Ground law essentially does away with the duty to retreat. The Castle Doctrine says there's no duty to retreat in the home. The Stand Your Ground law extends that, clarifies that, makes it unambiguous, and then extends it to other situations. So we're part of where the ambiguity comes in and why people are seeing the police not being, aggressive or about investigating this, is that the Stand Your Ground actually provides immunity to the person. And so immunity means you cannot be charged. So there needs to be some sort of determination or interpretation or some sort of assessment of whether the self-defense claim is legitimate. If it is legitimate, then you're immune from prosecution, which means things cannot go forward. It's not like a self-defense legal defense where you go into court and we hear everything and you claim it's self-defense. You've already been charged and accused. If you have immunity, you can't be charged and accused. So that in part explains the inaction of the police, not on the investigation side, but in terms of moving the case forward. And if the police decide that there's reason for self-defense and then following that immunity, then the prosecutor would likely think the same thing. And so that's why you didn't see anything aggressive moving forward in terms of handing off the case down the line to others in the system. On the other hand, at least the apparent lack of aggressiveness or enthusiasm for the investigation phase and the claims that came out by the Miami Herald, which is that the police were leading the various people there as taking statements, leading them along by suggesting self-defense and by suggesting different scenarios that would fit that defense. That actually has nothing to do with the law per se. That's more of a, it's not a legal related phenomenon. It's more sort of a sociological phenomenon that has to do with police and the people that they police.
Let's get down to the moment the police arrive. Does Zimmerman has to make the case that the dead kid attacked him, right?
Yes.
And apparently that's what he did.
Yeah, apparently that's what he did. And at least in the newspaper stories, they claim that he was cut and there was some blood on him. And there were grass and dirt stains on his clothes. So it was consistent with the story that there was a tussle. Now, that didn't say who initiated it or how it came about, but there was some sort of physical struggle. And in that struggle, apparently, Zimmerman had gotten cut. Also, the initial reports, when they listened to the 911 tapes, which revealed a cry for help several times and then a gunshot, and then no more cries for help, silence. The initial stories were that the cries for help were coming from Zimmerman, that is the person with the gun. And so, you know, if that's true, then that lends support to this notion that it was self-defense. Now, as they're reexamining that tape and cleaning it up and sort of thinking through the situation, the reports are starting to change, and they're saying that either it could be or it might be Trayvon. So in that case, that self-defense claim is diminished if Trayvon is the one yelling for help, and then he gets shot.
And there is no actual witnesses to this scuffle, right? This is all the word of the version of George Zimmerman.
Right. There's no eyewitnesses, witnesses that visually observed it. On the other hand, neighbors heard what was going on and called 911.
Right.
And then, as you mentioned, he was talking to his girlfriend in Miami on the phone at the time, and she heard some of this go on.
Right. And he apparently said to her, this guy was chasing me, you know, as opposed to him being the aggressor. He was trying to get away from this guy. And from the 911 call that the police released, where Zimmerman is talking to the 911 dispatcher, he's obviously intent on getting this guy, because he doesn't say, I'm sick of these people getting away with it. He'd created this scenario that this was a dangerous person on drugs, and he starts to chase after him, and the dispatcher says, don't do that, you know, don't follow him, we'll take care of it. No, I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Right.
And then he says, damn it, you know, I'm sick of them getting away with it. So he'd already had, I mean, it's pretty clear, in Zimmerman's mind, he believed that this was a criminal getting away with crime.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, Zimmerman was sort of enthusiastic about his role in the Crime Watch and took it very seriously. He wanted to be a law enforcement officer himself, but was not at this time. Zimmerman suspected him of these things, and at least to my mind, when you know I heard the call into the police department on this, he uses what are sort of common, you know, sort of standard phrases. You know, he might be on drugs. Well, there's really nothing to support that conclusion. I mean, I guess this was not an interrogation on the phone. But, you know, apparently Zimmerman had in mind a picture of what an offender would look like or be like, and that included someone who was on drugs and someone who was stealthy and casing the area. And perhaps even stereotypically, it might have included the idea that offenders are, for the most part, young male African-Americans, and that may have fed into...
Well, he actually specifically says that he's black, though, doesn't he, in the tape?
Yes. He does. So, and, you know, but on the other hand, from a legal point of view, Zimmerman may have acted rashly or imprudently or foolishly or impetuously, but now he was not necessarily acting illegally. And that becomes the question for the police and the prosecutor. Was his actions illegal? Of course, what preceded or comes before the incident is important, but ultimately, under the Stand Your Ground law, if he felt he was being threatened and he was being attacked, he could claim justification for using deadly force.
Well, Ken Adams again, Professor of Criminal Justice at the College of Health and Public Affairs at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. The impression is that the police knew this fellow. He'd called in a whole bunch of times and presumably was over-enthusiastic, shall we say, to be very, very fair here. He sounds a bit like a wannabe policeman. I don't know where you say he wanted to be a policeman. Isn't the whole point about police training that the differentiates policemen from, say, you know, neighborhood watch people or the security, private security firms, is that they go through rigorous training about the use of deadly force, and they don't presume a crime is to be taking place. They investigate it. I mean, I'm just surprised that the police chief, and he's under a fire, the Sanford police chief, Bill Lee, they've all seemed to have given this guy a wide berth, but they knew who he was. Has anybody stepped forward? Because I would have thought from the point of view of the police that they find these kind of wannabe cops, wouldn't they be, you know, nervous about them and skeptical of them and perhaps disapprove of them?
Well, you know, I don't know. They may have sort of ambivalent feelings towards them. On the one hand, people like Zimmerman could be seen as wannabe cops, and if you were a police officer, that's not necessarily desirable. And perhaps in some small way it's flattering. But, you know, on the one hand, while they may bring to you all sorts of minor things and be sort of over-enthusiastic about uncovering potential crimes and things like that, for which, you know, after a while you start feeling this is a waste of my time and all of those things, you know, the flip side is that, you know, police might not mind having someone like Zimmerman walking the streets, because if they get into an altercation with someone and they're starting to be on the losing end of that altercation, someone like Zimmerman would charge right in and try to help the police officer. So,
But Zimmerman was armed with a 9mm pistol. Is that legal to be in the neighborhood watch and have a concealed weapon? I mean, it's one thing to help a police officer, it's another thing to be armed, and in this case, use the deadly force.
Well, in Florida, yes, it's legal, and it doesn't take much to be able to get a weapon. Anybody who is legally entitled to possess a weapon can very easily get one, so that's not unusual.
So he was able to have this concealed weapon. The police didn't know he had a weapon, did they? If they would have known, the dispatcher told him not to follow the kid. Presumably, if they knew he was armed, they'd be more emphatic about that, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, certainly. Well, you know, you'd mentioned the sort of this notion that you know, police, of course, are trained and they know how to handle these things, and we should allow them to take care of it, and that's all true. In this particular context, with this community watch program that they have, there was no real training for the people. Okay, so they come by and they give people stickers to put on their doors, and they put a little sign in the neighborhood. And I think from what I gather in the paper, Zimmerman was the self-appointed captain of Community Watch. It's not clear who else was in that group. And so from a police point of view, this is not desirable. You don't want untrained people running the streets on your behalf. And in that training, a lot of what they will emphasize is that you're a civilian. You do not have the same arrest powers as a police officer. You do not have the same training as a police officer in how to handle situations. The dispatcher did the right thing by saying, do not follow him. And the dispatcher also did the right thing by saying, do not confront him. These are all standard policies in a well-organized community watch operation. This community watch operation sort of had a little bit of a rogue element to it, where apparently there wasn't much organization to it and there was no training for it, and so people could decide for themselves how they would operate. But, you know, every police chief in the United States will tell you that they don't want citizens chasing after potential offenders or suspected offenders. They don't want citizens confronting people they think are offenders, because many often the outcome is someone gets seriously hurt.
Which is clearly, you know, a 17-year-old boy is dead. In closing, Ken Adams, you mentioned that there's a history of racial tension in the city of Sanford, just to the north of you. The victim's black, the perpetrator, or at least the fellow who shot him, Zimmerman, is white, Hispanic, I guess, reports say. Police chief, is he white?
No. Well, yes, I think he is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, unless there's some justice done here, this is going to be an open wound for some time.
Yes.
I thank you for joining us here today, Ken Adams.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Ken Adams, who's a professor of criminal justice in the College of Health and Public Affairs at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined in the studio by the author of a new book about the war on women. Happiness is a warm gun. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Nancy Cohen, the author of Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America, historian and author of two books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism, 1965 to 1914. Her writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Business History Review, and the Huffington Post. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy Cohen.
Hi, Ian. Happy to be here with you.
And it certainly appears that the politics of the body have taken over our body politic. Not a day passes without some new Republican initiative to make life more difficult for women, particularly those who want to get an abortion, to humiliate them, to tie them up in the knots, to cause them unnecessary expense. Just the other day in Tennessee, they have a bill that's passing through the legislature that would actually publish the abortion providers, home addresses, et cetera, so that the Operation Rescue people can harass them. And now one of the other legislatures, I'm not sure which one is now claiming that women fake rape in order to get an abortion. Women are very tricky, aren't they?
Yes. Well, the first line of my book opens, perhaps if the pill had not been invented, American politics would be very different today. And I think that's being proved every day now. So Delirium tells a story about how a small group of reactionaries, who frankly are obsessed with other people's sex lives, have hijacked American politics. And what we're seeing today in these Republican legislatures, in the Republican race, with Rick Santorum, of all people, being a front runner for the president of the United States, is the kind of logical result of 40 years of sexual counter-revolution.
And how does it tie in? Because it's clearly a resurgence at the moment. I mean, it's peaking. And I think a lot of women probably thought, oh, you know, they have arguments over birth control. That was, you know, decades ago. But they're now back with a vengeance. And How much is it tied into the kind of coordination that we see with the campaign finance overturning, the super PACs, ALEC, which is this organization that the Koch brothers and others have funded that has organized Republican legislatures with these prepackaged bills, you know, voter suppression bills and others, which coincidentally are being through all the legislatures. So there's a real pattern there. Give me a sense of what's the organizing principle here, if there is one.
Very good question. So the organizing principle is that back in the late 70s, early 80s, the right-wing establishment, the new right, the money people, the 1%, made a kind of devil's bargain with the rising religious right, thought that they could control them, essentially. And, you know, in Reagan's, you know, three-legged stool, the neoconservatives, the economic conservatives, and the social conservatives all got together to forward this right-wing agenda. The story I tell is about how in the 90s, really, the establishment and the 1%ers lost control to the sexual fundamentalists. And the fact is, there's never been any kind of electoral majority for ending Social Security or ending Medicare or repealing the Clean Air Act. The ground troops of the right wing, of the Republican Party, are these people who first became politically active to turn back the sexual revolution, feminism, and gay rights. They then formed the religious right, and they took over the Republican Party from the bottom to the top. So certainly you have the super PACs keeping a weak candidate such as Santorum in the race so long enough that he could actually appeal to the people who make up the majority of Republican voters. And on their side, on the religious right side, they ally with these the money power because they want to deprive Democrats of the money and power to impose gay rights, to impose women's rights, to impose sex education, to impose science education on the public. So they're committed to starving government because they think that, you know, the secular humanists, godless Democrats have taken it over.
So would there be an analogy here then with what happened with the German industrialists and the early Nazis? In other words, the German industrialists thought, well, Hitler is obviously a bit of an extremist, but he is beating up on the unions and he's totally pro-business and we can work with him. And then, of course, they found out that they couldn't. Is this a bit of a case of where the Republicans cynically thought, well, here we will have our version of the Democratic union organizers, the precinct walkers, the stamp lickers? These are the people that will become our new, grassroots workers, but we'll be able to control them.
Yes, history is full of unintended consequences. So I would say the analogy of people in power looking for a mass of voters that they control is apt, but I don't want to take that as far to suggest that.
Let's not talk about fascism and make loose analogies here. I didn't mean it for that to be that way. But so we have my sense, though, again, let me introduce again Nancy Cohen, the author of Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. She's an historian and author of two books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism, 1965 to 1914. Now, I had a forum the other night at the UCLA Hammer Forum with Lawrence Lessig, who's leading proponent of campaign finance reform. We talked about the super PACs, which you just mentioned. He made the point that he thinks that the real issues in this country have nothing to do with left and right. In other words, we have been caught in a left and right polemic and counter-polemic, and that we're essentially being manipulated and distracted by that. That the real divide in America is between the insiders and the outsiders, and that is the 99% versus the 1% on the inside. Is it possible that sexual politics is an extension of a kind of manipulation? Because the Saudi royals use sex as a way to completely subjugate yes. their own people. There are so many laws there that you're spending every minute of the day wondering whether you're showing one inch of skin, you know, and you can't get round a revolution. So you follow my logic?
I do. And I would absolutely disagree and say it's the reverse, that these people, I figure they're about 15 to 20% of the national electorate, no more, a tiny minority who've really commandeered the political discourse. It's at the grassroots level that they're pushing these, you know, very extreme measures against abortion, actually define birth control as abortion, feel that sex is destroying America, that women having sexual freedom and having economic freedom has destroyed the traditional family, which has destroyed America. So I see a lot more of this actually coming out of what is an authentic, you know, right-wing sexual fundamentalism, pushing some of these, you know, the one percenters, the elite, actually in a direction that I don't think they want to go, because they know that they actually can't win any elections if they talk about this publicly.
But how come they're so successful, disproportionate to their numbers? The fact that you've got all these state legislatures, and you must admit, in 2010, they made tremendous inroads, and that a lot of that was organized by Dick Armey and Karl Rove, neither of whom I think are on the religious right. They're more cynical, they're more political pros. So explain to me the disproportionate political influence that they have.
Yes, it comes from their brilliance at electoral politics. Starting in the early years of the sexual counter-revolution in the late 70s, these ordinary activists infiltrated the Republican Party at the local and precinct level. They rewrote state Republican platforms, you know, including adding things like gays should be quarantined. A lot of the leaders of the Republican Party now, people like Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, Scott Walker, actually came up through the ranks of this movement, starting out in local politics. And so what happens is, in low turnout elections, they control the Republican Party, and they always turn out, and they always stay active. And so in an election like 2010, which was low turnout, they can really shift state legislatures. They have a particularly strong impact in kind of low knowledge elections, so local elections, state elections. They tend to do far less well in Senate elections or presidential elections. And so they won these elections in 2010 by staying politically active. And what I show in my book is that the so-called Tea Party is really nothing more than a rebranding of the Christian right. And yes, Dick Armey and Karl Rove funded them, but Ralph Reed was also very involved. All these far-right Christian right organizations were active in these, you know, Republican Tea Party primaries in 2010.
So there's no surprise then that Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin are the couple of the stars of the Tea Party.
Exactly,
Again, I speak with Nancy Cohen, the author of Delirium, How the Sexual Revolution is Polarizing America. So how did this what's wrong then with the secular humanists, for God's sake? What's wrong with you women? I mean, how could you let this happen if they're the minority?
It's a good question. So I don't think I would blame women. In part, the Democratic Party has been complicit in this, because the Democratic Party has had its own sexual counter-revolution within. Not so much that there have been reactionaries on these questions in the Democratic Party. That kind of ended by 1980 or so. But every time Democrats lose elections, they default to this collective panic where they blame their base, they blame women, they blame feminists, they blame gays, they blame elitists for alienating mainstream America and driving it away. And so whenever Democrats get scared, as they did the year before 2010, for example, when their numbers, you know, when their approval ratings were clearly dropping, is they tried to appeal to this kind of imaginary white male conservative, and they stop talking about the things that matter to their own voters, and their own voters got demoralized and stayed home. So 40 million people who voted in 2008 didn't vote in 2010. And they were disproportionately the young, minorities, unmarried women, and Democrats.
So you're saying that by the and Obama's using the same strategy now on gay marriage. You know, the gay lobby is saying we want you to embrace it, and he's saying no, I'm evolving, and he doesn't want to step out ahead because he's afraid he's going to lose some centrist votes. You're saying that's a mirage.
I'm saying it's a mirage because all the studies by political scientists show that Americans have become much more socially progressive over the last 30 years, and that Democrats have actually won elections because people have become more socially progressive. And where they're losing these voters that they think are conservative on cultural issues, you know, the, you know, proverbial Reagan Democrat white man, those men actually aren't voting for Democrats because they've soured on democratic liberal economics, not on the cultural programs. Mm-hmm. You know, there's evidence that gay marriage had absolutely no effect on Bush's reelection in 2004. So I do think what Obama's doing now with gay marriage is a prime example of democratic panic. And I am pretty convinced that if he stood on principle, he would win voters for simply standing on principle for what most people think he believes anyway. And he would also pick up votes.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of gods, guns, and gays, you're saying that they don't – I mean, the right is obsessed with gays. But what about guns? You're saying that it's really the Reagan Democrats, you know, the fact that, you know, we've got Joe the Plumber running in Ohio now against Nancy Kaptur. That should be interesting. you're saying that there's no question that the Democratic Party, it's an absolute indictment of them that they can't hold working people in within their ranks. I mean, there's no question about
well,
that.
Well, but the studies also show that that's a myth, that to the extent that Democrats have lost working class voters, it's been almost entirely in the South. And that in the North, yes, white working class identifies less Democratic than they did 40 years ago, but at a lower rate than middle class and upper income people identify Democratic. Class voting has actually gotten more, has gotten stronger over the last 30 years. I mean, this is what's frustrating. You know, academics show that this is the case, but the exit polls and the pundits keep repeating the myths.
Well, we're going to have to revisit you and your book, Nancy, because we're really scratching the surface here and we've run out of time. Again, I've been speaking with Nancy Cohen, the author of Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. She's an historian and author of two books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism, 1865 to 1914, and her writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Business History Review, and the Huffington Post. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm